Well, good morning. Thank you, Representative Weatherford and Commissioner Bronson. Speaking on behalf of the U.S. ethanol industry, the Renewable Fuels Association, I should tell you, is the National Trade Association for the U.S. ethanol industry. We're based in Washington, D.C. We represent about 80% of all ethanol produced in the U.S. So on behalf of all my members, I want to thank you for putting this conference on. The Southeast market is tremendously important to our industry, both as a production center as well as an end user. When I was thinking about how I wanted to put together a presentation, and it's generally done at the 30,000-foot level, I got to thinking about, well, you know, I spend most of my days trying to fight back critics of ethanol, whether it's food versus fuel, whether it's energy balance, environmental concerns. And while I could certainly spend all my time talking about that, I decided that I wanted to give you, you know, the nuts and bolts. What is the industry doing today? Give you an appreciation of the scope across the country, as well as impress upon you, and I'm sure you're already very well aware, otherwise you wouldn't be here, the importance of ethanol as a renewable fuel and an important part in our motor fuel market. So with that, just to look, it's important to appreciate, you know, the scope of the industry that we're talking about. In 2006, when we ended the calendar year, we had about 5.3 billion gallons of production capacity online and operating. In 2006, we produced just under 5 billion gallons of renewable fuel. And we used, with imports, about 5.5 billion gallons. As I put this together last night, and these numbers may have changed, I haven't checked my email this morning, there are 123 biorefineries in 20 states. Those just aren't corn-producing Midwestern states. They're states like Arizona and California and some of those non-traditional states. Additionally, there are 75 under construction and several expanding. So we're talking about an industry in the next 24 to 36 months that will be well in excess of 12 billion gallons of not only capacity, but actual production. Just to give you an appreciation of the market that we're part of, it's estimated that America uses about 140 billion gallons of gasoline. If you were to blend 10% ethanol in every gallon across the country, you're looking at a 14 billion gallon U.S. ethanol industry. Again, last year we produced just under 5. You also see what a relatively small but very important piece of the puzzle E85 is. You know, today with 1,200 stations out of 170,000 across the country, it's still relatively low in terms of market penetration. We're certainly not selling nearly the volumes of E85 that we are ethanol as a blending component, but nonetheless, E85 is a very critical market for our industry, and we certainly look forward to working with our partners in the automotive industry to help move that agenda forward. Just a couple of stats, too, to appreciate sort of where ethanol is. As you're well aware, MTBE was phased out last year rather abruptly and rapidly by oil refiners. And so to fill that void, ethanol flowed in. It flowed both from domestic production as well as imports where needed. And that is sort of the size of the MTBE replacement demand we were looking at. Today, ethanol is blended to more than 50% of the nation's gasoline. Every gallon of gasoline, for example, in California is blended with ethanol. The same in the nation's largest cities like New York, Boston, in D.C. In production, we're adding 380,000 barrels of ethanol a day to the motor fuel mix. Now, that's significant because if you look at what happened with gasoline prices this spring, the refineries were offline for whatever reason. I mean, one was a raccoon, I think, bit through a power line in California and shut the refinery down. Price was up 7 cents the next day in California. So it's important to understand that ethanol is filling that gap when refineries are not operating up to speed. So now the fun stuff. Why ethanol? You know, we look at it sort of as it's sort of the three E's. There obviously is the environmental component when you talk about global climate change, when you talk about air pollution in America's cities. There is absolutely an economic piece to this puzzle. I'm fortunate enough to travel around to groundbreakings and grand openings in small communities across the country where an ethanol biorefinery may very well be the first industry to build a brand new plant in that county in a generation, sometimes more. A case study, a small town in Missouri called LaDania, built a plant there by Poet. It's a 60 million gallon a year ethanol biorefinery. There are 150 people in the town, maybe. No paved roads. The main street is, they just tar the gravel so that it doesn't kick up dust. At their grand opening celebration, they had 3,500 people stream through that plant to sit down and listen to industry leaders talk about what it meant and to really get a feel, you know, of what this means for a county like that. I mean, for that town, it is a godsend. So looking at it a little bit more closely, and what the RFA does predominantly is work with lawmakers in Washington and regulators in Washington and around the state, or around the states. And the environment is an increasingly important topic. You in Florida are well aware of the role low carbon fuels, carbon standards are playing in the debate here in Florida, and on a national level, it is equally important. In Washington, D.C., lawmakers are ever increasingly viewing our energy future through that low-carbon lens. We believe ethanol is uniquely positioned to capitalize on that. If you take the most conservative estimate for today's ethanol reduction, greenhouse gas reduction from ethanol is 18%. It's likely much higher than that in up to 29%. That's with today's technology. Future technologies and a lot of what's being discussed here today, the cellulose, the other materials, you could be talking about a 90% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions compared to an equivalent volume of gasoline. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, we're talking about better air quality. The American Lung Association out of metropolitan Chicago, for instance, attributes the blending of ethanol and the gasoline there to reducing asthma-related cases by 25%. You know, that has a significant impact. You know, I deal with a lot of code orange days in Washington, D.C., where it's very difficult just to walk to work and catch a breath. And what I haven't put up here but is also important and I think is rather timely given the situation with the oil refinery in Coffeyville, ethanol is a biodegradable fuel. You know, if it spills, it is biodegradable. Unlike MTBE, for instance, where just a small drop would make the groundwater unfit to drink. You know, ethanol is a renewable fuel, and it's biodegradable. The economic portion of this is one that can't be ignored either. And the importance of this is we're talking about American jobs and American economic activity that is being generated in small communities and rural areas, but also on the nation as a whole. I mean, these are dollars that are being reinvested, and I think the numbers sort of speak for themselves. I mean, 160,000 new jobs supported by the ethanol industry. You know, when we're talking about outsourcing jobs to other countries, you know, this is a very important new job creation mechanism, and it's helping revitalize, again, these many rural communities. One thing that I do want to draw your attention to, a lot of the time people will criticize ethanol for the subsidies. Well, you're nothing but living on the government dole. If you take a look at the numbers, $2.7 billion generated in new tax revenue to the federal government from the construction and operation of ethanol facilities across the country. Another additional $2 billion in state and local government tax increases. We're talking about money that can be used for roads, for schools, for first responders. If you put that together with the savings that ethanol is helping to ensure from our federal farm program payments, you're talking about $10 billion of either money saved or new economic and new tax revenue generated. By comparison, the tax incentive that you all are familiar with, the 51 cents per gallon, amounted to about $2.5 billion. So clearly this is a program that is paying off and in doing what Congress and lawmakers intended it to do. Just to put a face and give you a feel of what we're talking about sort of on the micro level in the communities. I mean, here are the numbers for a 100 million gallon a year ethanol plant. You know, the numbers are there. You can see them. It's a tremendous boost to the local economy, to the state economy. But there are real people behind these economic numbers. I mean, there are farmers who are now getting a market-driven price for their corn. In turn, they're able to buy new machinery. They're able to buy a new pickup. You know, and so then the town benefits. Well, then there are new businesses open up. Maybe it's that restaurant that closed a few years ago because people left. There were no jobs. Now there are jobs both at the plant and at other businesses springing up across the area, and so maybe that restaurant comes back. And what's not on here and what you can't really quantify with a number is the opportunity it provides for young people like me to return home. I grew up on a farm in northern Iowa. My hometown's 300 people, and when I go back, you know, there isn't a lot left. But when I travel around to communities who have put in an ethanol biorefinery or a biodiesel refinery, you know, now all of a sudden, hey, there's a good job there. I can come back. I can bring my family back. I can raise my children, you know, in the same environment in which I was raised. And that is a very important piece of the puzzle. And finally, not to be last, but certainly not least, we're talking about energy security. We're talking about becoming more self-reliant on American know-how, on good old-fashioned American hard work. And these are some of the numbers. I mean, 206 million barrels in displaced oil imports may not sound like much compared to, you know, what we import, what we produce here in this country. But if you take a look at it closer, if you take the numbers from the federal government and do it on an annualized basis, the 206 million barrels that we displaced last year will be more than the entire volume of oil that we import from Iraq. Or, maybe a little more poignant given our location, it is half that we would import from our friends in Venezuela. So it is clearly a very important energy security tool. So why is the industry growing? Well, first, the federal legislative policies, state legislative policies, regulatory issues are still the number one driver for increasing ethanol demand and ethanol use across the country. You know, the focus of legislators and regulators, as we talked about, you know, is the environment. Ethanol's very environmentally friendly profile. I mean, we are talking about greenhouse gas emissions reduction. We are talking about reductions in fine particulate matter and things like that. And when you consider everything that's being done in terms of reducing carbon to deal with global climate change, you know, ethanol is a pretty important tool. The second point maybe is sustained high gas and oil prices. I mean, I don't think anyone in this room is terribly confident that we're going to see $10 barrel of oil again, you know, or maybe even $2.50 gasoline. I don't know. I didn't check the price when I came in. And importantly, under that heading was a new report, I believe it was released yesterday, by largely the petroleum industry itself, in which it talked about the growing demand from the USA in terms of its energy needs. Their conclusion was global production of petroleum will increase, but not enough to meet global demand. And so what do? Well, you've got to start looking at something else, and lo and behold, they were talking about ethanol. I mean, we are getting to a point where we have to start looking at what happens when we start getting down the other side of the world oil production curve, you know, when it becomes an even more intense competition for fuel. You know, we've got to start today to position ourselves to be better able to take advantage of those situations. And the third thing is new markets in higher blends. Obviously, moving into the Southeast is important for our industry. You know, it's very important that the Southeast capitalize on the production, but to really realize the full benefits of ethanol, in Florida, in Georgia, in other southeastern states, is you've got to have the policies in place that allow the refiners to blend ethanol as well. And so that's something that our industry is very committed to working for. We're also looking at maybe 10% isn't the number. Now, I know some of the small engine manufacturers and some of the automakers will tell you, you know, we can't do it. 10%, that might be it. Well, you know, we think there may be some room to move that up. Certainly Brazil has seemed to figure it out. Where that number is, we don't know, but we certainly think that there should be the necessary research done to find out, you know, maybe the number's E12, maybe it's E17. I don't think anybody really knows until the information and the data come in. And then thirdly, under that tab, and we touched on it before, is E85 growth. As we expand into new markets with the 10% blends, it makes it easier for gas stations to convert one of their pumps to E85. The ethanol is already coming in a blending level and is available. I'm pretty sure Robert will touch on the flex fuel vehicles here in the Southeast and what an important market it could be for E85. As I mentioned, you know, what we do is beat down doors on Capitol Hill by and large. And just sort of a brief overview of what's happened in Washington since the new Congress was seated in January, there's been no fewer than 165 pieces of legislation dealing with renewable fuels in some fashion or another. Production, use, infrastructure, you name it, they've looked at it. Again, the environment is certainly the lens by which many are viewing legislative activity. And we also have a pretty major piece of legislation that provides us an opportunity as well as Congress starts to look at the new Farm Bill. You know, where are the opportunities to provide agriculture the means to become an even greater part of this pie? I mean, we're talking about how do we help them develop those cellulosic feedstocks? You know, we know how to grow corn, and we're improving how we do it, but we know how to do it. How do we help farmers, you know, maybe go to a switchgrass or a fast-growing tree or something like that? So there are certainly some opportunities there. And then just one bill that I will note came out of the Senate not too long ago, the crux of which is an expansion of the current renewable fuel standard to 36 billion gallons by 2022. The important provision in there to put the fears of food and fuel folks to rest is 21 billion gallons of that must come from something other than corn-based ethanol. All right, these, you know, where do we go? This is based on what we're looking at in terms of what is being built today, what has steel in the ground, concrete being poured, and these are very rough estimates, but it does represent the volume of ethanol we believe to be the capacity, and then as well as then the subsequent production each year. And as you can see, the industry is growing extremely rapidly, and we soon will come to the point where we do hit, you know, that blending wall, they call it, where we are 10% of the overall gasoline market. And then that's where markets like E85 and higher ethanol blends really come into play. And finally, I just want to touch on some of the next generation of ethanol. I mean, we are talking about cellulose and wood chips and citrus waste and all the things that you can think of. I mean, we're going to need it all, and the research and the development needs to be done both by the federal government, by state universities, and by our industry itself. By working together, we can all make sure that these technologies come to the marketplace much sooner than most people believe is possible today, as well as continuing to prove on the process that we have today. I mean, by no means is the ethanol industry static. By no means are we satisfied with the achievements we've had to date. We're looking at ways, how do you improve the process today? How do you get more ethanol from that bushel of corn? You know, how do you continue to improve your environmental footprint and become more efficient? And you're looking at ways and technologies that reduce water use, that use alternate forms of energy for the plants. You know, instead of natural gas, you're using cattle manure, or you're using a biomass gasifier that, you know, you have a big storm come in, you've got a lot of limbs down, why not turn that into to fuel to power your plant? So this is us. Please contact us. Please log on and see what we're all about. I thought about the title of my presentation today, too, and I wanted something easy so when you looked at it, you knew what I was going to be talking about, and I think it's pretty self-explanatory. But I also wanted to underscore a very important point, that today's ethanol industry is having tremendously positive impacts on our country, both in the environmental arena, on the economic development side, and in the energy security side. Certainly, we're all excited about the future, and the future is bright. But what happens often, and critics of ethanol are pretty good at this, is they overlook what we've accomplished, you know, in the last 10 years, the last 5 years. They discount the benefits that our industry is providing today. And I think that's a mistake. Our industry is certainly here today. We're here to stay. And we look forward to working with everyone in this room to get over that next hurdle and to really capture that next horizon. Thanks so much.